Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the difference between seeing something in the movies and experiencing something in real life? We walk in knowing that what's on the screen is just a story, and yet we often flinch, duck, cringe, cry, and laugh right along with the characters. So what's going on in our brains when that happens, and how do our story memories differ from those we make out of personal experiences? Jeffrey M. Zaks is professor of psychology and radiology at Washington University in St. Louis. His new book is called Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Jeff, welcome to Think.
It's good to be here, Chris.
You call the brain a model-building machine. What does that mean, and how does it play into the way we experience movies?
Sure. In order to comprehend what's happening in front of us and to react to it appropriately, we build little representations in our heads of what's happening out there. And a good name for those is models, because they capture some of the specific image-like properties, but they also have components that you can move around and update.
So why do our brains need these models?
Well, if you want to infer, like, what might happen next, or in the real world, what might happen if you do something, you need a representation that you can use to build a simulation. And models are just that kind of representation.
So, for example, knowing that if we touch a hot stove, we're likely to get burned, we can use that memory. Is that an example of the model?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example, because if you just had an image of a hot stove, if you look over at the stove and you just make yourself an image and then you go on about your business, that's not going to allow you to anticipate those consequences where you might burn yourself. What you need is a representation that's got like parts in it that captures the fact that the burners are not the same thing as the knobs, and they have different properties, and the implications of interacting with them are different. Now, then you take that into a theater, and we've got brains that are built for reasoning based on that kind of representation. But of course, what you see on the screen can't reach out and touch you at all. It can't burn you. And so a lot of the surprising intensity and surprising effects that we see in the psychology and neuroscience movies comes from the fact that our brains are built for this interactive, planning-based environment, whereas a movie just kind of jumps in and leverages off that.
How does the multi-sensory experience of movies affect our recall of the stories they tell us? Are we more likely to recall, say, the film version of a story than details of the book that it was based on?
That's a great topic. You know, there's been wonderful pages written about the process of adapting things from one medium to another. There's some kind of basic affordances that differ between movies and films. So in a movie, it's easy and, in fact, obligatory to present features like the color of things or the shape of things, relative size. You can't make a picture of something without presenting a lot of that information. Now, of course, in particular cases, you can omit things, like you can make a black and white movie. But for the most part, you've got all these visual properties that are more or less obligatory. On the other hand, you can have a feature-length movie about a character who's never given a name, whereas if you try and do that in a book, it becomes really awkward really fast. So naming things and categorizing them and assigning roles that language renders obligatory. So, like, for example, try and write a novel, and people have done this experimentally, but try and write a novel about a character without specifying the character's gender. It's super hard. Whereas in a film, you can go a lot farther without giving that kind of categorical identity information.
We all assume that, like, the better, the crisper, the brighter images are, the better they're going to be for our experience. But I wonder, now that we have, like, fMRI technology that can really evaluate this, is, say, you know, a 3D color movie in high definition more emotionally affecting to us than, a good old movie in black and white without stereo sound?
Yeah, let me take those two apart.
Okay. First,
let me just say a general thing, which is a lot of what I reviewing this book winds up telling us that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the story, man. And so a lot of these surface properties, they have peripheral effects, but really the representations that drive our affective responses and the grip of a movie are at the level of the story. But so let me take 3D and crispness separately. So what we call a 3D movie is a movie that's presented stereoscopically. That means that there's a slightly different image going to the left eye and the right eye. And stereoscopy is one of a bunch of cues that we use to figure out how far things are away from us. There are, of course, other cues. So there's occlusion, right? So if you have one object in front of another, the one that's in front hides some of the stuff, some parts of the ones behind. And at longer distances, there are things like aerial perspective, which is just that because of the atmosphere, things get fuzzier as you go far away. So there's a bunch of depth cues, but stereo depth is really a compelling cue. And so from the early days of filmmaking, they tried to add it into movies. And there's no doubt that in terms of the subjective experience, it adds a bunch. And you can see that in the brain's response. There's a particular area called area MT, or the human MT complex, that responds selectively to motion. And that area also responds selectively to stereo disparity and to motion in depth that's based on stereo disparity.
And so the other part in terms of crispness, does that
make a
difference?
Crispness. Yeah. So crispness is getting cashed out these days in a big way in terms of high frame rate. So you may have seen there's a bit of a kerfuffle when Peter Jackson started filming the first Hobbit movie at 48 frames per second. For like 100 years, the standard frame rate for cinema has been 24 frames a second. For TV, it's about 30 frames a second. But the new digital cameras and projectors are giving us the opportunity to project things at higher frame rates, and people are starting to experiment with it. In the case of the first part of The Hobbit, people mostly reported they really didn't like it. It's not totally clear whether it was the high frame rate itself or other choices that were made about the color palette and the way it was filmed. I've seen a heads-up comparison of the same scene filmed at frame rates from 24 frames per second up to 120. And in the audience I saw that with, most people did not like the very high frame rates that much.
How is it that we identify with movie characters? Are we essentially living through them when we watch a movie in a way that is different than, say, going to the mall with our best friend and kind of imagining what they might be experiencing?
Well, the weird thing about it is that it's more the same than different. We bring the same mechanisms to bear that we bring to bear, that we evolved to deal with our friends and our family and our loved ones. We bring those same mechanisms to bear when we go to the theater. And with a little bit of explicit effort, we usually shut some of them down or dampen them down, but less so than I think we appreciate. So one mechanism works its way through facial imitation. There's this principle that I call the mirror effect, which is that in lots of situations, the nervous system is built so that if you see something up out in the world or up on a screen, you tend to do a corresponding thing. And that can produce an emotional response. If somebody smiles on a screen, you're going to tend to form your face into a smile without even noticing it. If you watch audiences, you can see this. And it turns out that once your face is in a smile, that activates the rest of the emotional program that's associated with smiling, and that tends to produce a more positive affect. You can see this in the lab by doing funny things like giving people pencils to bite in their teeth. And so if you hold a pencil in your teeth, it frames your face into a smile. And people don't realize that that's what it's doing. And then they walk out feeling happier.
And we're so accustomed to like the conventions of editing, right? That nobody really notices now unless editing really draws attention to itself. Why are we able to so easily, though, follow along with cuts and quick camera movements that might take us from like a wide shot of a car chase to a POV out the driver's window, back to a streetscape view and then something different? That's not at all like real life, and yet it's not at all hard to follow in a movie.
Yeah, one of the things that got me started on this whole topic was just the question of like, why when you see just a simple cut, a cut is when one run of the camera ends and another one starts. And, you know, why when you see a simple cut, doesn't your head explode, right? That's something that never happened in the history of the evolution of the human visual system. And in current action movies, you might have sequences where there are cuts going by at the rate of like two or three a second. And so, you know, why when this happens, doesn't it just blow out the system? And as far as we know, it looks like the real answer is that, well, yeah, leaving your eyeballs pointing in one particular direction and leaving them open and having the full scene replaced instantaneously, that doesn't happen. But there's a bunch of things that happen in our normal visual experience that are actually pretty close to it, and our brains... visual systems have evolved to cope with that. So one important thing that happens is we move our eyes all the time. Most of the movements we make are these jerky, fast movements where you're fixating on an object. They're called saccades. And we make about three a second. And while you're making one, you're functionally blind for about 20 to 80 milliseconds. And the other thing we do, of course, is blink. And then you know, other stuff happens. People walk in front of us and occlude our vision. We get distracted. And so our visual systems evolved to maintain continuity of the model that you're building across all of those discontinuities. And a well-edited film mimics the discontinuities that you'd experience in an active natural vision situation, but it spoon-feeds them to you.
Yeah, I, of course, now I'm noticing myself blinking every few seconds because I'm paying attention. But ordinarily, you go through days and weeks and months of your life without thinking a bit about this.
Absolutely. And I mean, and nobody, even, you know, even those of us who do this for a living, you're totally right that when you're thinking about the blink system, you're more aware of your blinks, but you're still never aware of your saccades, these fast eye movements. And they're happening about 3 to 6 times as often.
It has occurred to me, Jeff, that if I think about my dreams, they feel a little bit like they're cut and edited in the way that a movie is. And I don't know if that's just the way we dream or if that's if the shape and the form of my dreams has been influenced by all the media I have watched.
Ah, that's a great one. We don't know the answer is the short thing. There's this long, you know, dance back and forth over the history of film between film and dreams. And a lot of it has a Freudian psychoanalytic bent. But, you know, for obvious reasons, it's really tough to get any data, right? So you can do studies where you wake people up and ask them the content of their dreams. People are starting to do studies where you record brain data, either electrical or MRI data, while people are awake and experiencing known things. So you might show people pictures of, you know, cups and faces and houses and cars, and then let them go to sleep and try and figure out what they're dreaming about. But that's early days. And the fine-grained perceptual structure of like, you know, how do you transition from one thing to another in a dream? We just don't know.
We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey M. Zaks. He is professor of psychology and radiology at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the new book, Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. If you'd like to ask a question or share a story, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychology and radiology professor Jeffrey M. Zaks of Washington University in St. Louis. He's got a new book out called Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. You're welcome to join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Jeff, in real life, I would describe myself as a low-frequency crier, right? It takes a lot to get me kind of worked up into tears. In movies, though, I frequently find that either I just cry unabashedly or I'm fighting tears if I don't, for some reason, want to cry. Why am I so much more emotional about somebody else's story on screen than I am about the events of my real life and people I care about?
Yeah, first of all, I'm right there with you. And I find this totally mystifying. So part of it is this thing we were talking about before, this pathway by which you involuntarily mirror behavior that's up on the screen, and that activates an emotion program. Another pathway that's important is the kind of intuitive one that we think about emotion, which is that we get invested in a person and we infer that something good or bad is going to happen to them. And if it's a good thing, we're happy. And if it's a bad thing, we're unhappy. And the thing that's strange about that is that these are fictive people, right? They're not real. They're just pixels. And so why do both of these things happen? Why do you imitate? Why do you make these inferences when it's just a fictional character on a screen? My answer to that is that we have these emotion systems. We can characterize them. We know a bit about their neurophysiology. They all evolved in the millions and billions of years before movies were invented. And when we walk into the theater, we don't set all that evolutionary history aside. We bring in those systems, and then the movie just takes them over. And it takes a little bit of something extra to kind of tamp that stuff down. And fighting against that is the fact that the people who make movies, the filmmakers, have a whole arsenal of control, of tricks to control the situation that, you know, don't happen in real life, right? So I can look away much more easily in real life. I can control the information that I'm exposed to much more easily. And the filmmaker can really amp up all of those stimulus parameters that produce an emotional response to levels that are, you know, higher than you experience in almost any real life situation.
So when you talk about, you know, not being able to look away, for example, if we see a close-up of an actor emoting strongly on screen, that fills our entire frame of vision, whereas sitting across the room from somebody, we might look away and look down at their hands or look out the window, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, you can, right? You can make these explicit decisions that I'm just going to close my eyes because this movie is too scary, or I'm getting too carried away. But short of doing that, you've surrendered yourself to the control of the filmmaker. There's a line that's attributed to Wordsworth that says that to appreciate a work of art, you have to engage in willing suspension of disbelief. But some of my colleagues looking at these kinds of results have proposed that it's actually kind of the opposite, that what you need to do, what you're actually doing, is engaging in a willing suspension of belief, that what takes the work is not suspending the disbelief, but shutting down the acceptance of whatever you read or watch as real. You have to do something extra to tag it as fiction.
How is it that we can watch movies and remember movies and never confuse them with things that actually happen to us? And it's not even the events of another character, but I know that I saw a scene of, say, a restaurant in a movie. I don't think to myself, wait, didn't I go there? Why is that?
We can't. So, in fact, people confuse events from movies with real life all the time. The cases where we're good, there are lots of cases where we can kind of rule out that it really happened based on our knowledge of the world, right? So if it's a memory of someone skydiving, and I know I've never been skydiving, then that's an easy one. But there are great experiments in situations where you do things like take people who are either knowledgeable about historical circumstances or have read up in the lab on a historical event, and then you let them watch a biographical picture or a historical picture that, for the sake of the story, distorts some of the historical facts. And it's very difficult to tell those things apart. And you can give general warnings that say, hey, you know, the filmmakers changed some stuff. Watch out for that. Doesn't really help much. If you encourage people to actively monitor while they're watching, that can help a little bit.
So all of the we should go into historical dramas with a skeptical eye.
Absolutely. I was thinking about this a little bit when the when all the drama about the film The Interview came out. And what I'm about to say should not be taken in any way as an endorsement of the North Korean regime. But it occurred to me that whoever got so upset about what Sony was releasing wasn't totally crazy to be concerned about it, because even though it's a farce and even though the filmmakers are very explicit that they're not making factual claims about the particular events portrayed in the movie, they have that disclaimer at the end. The data are really strong that if you show people a film like that and then ask them to sort out later, is this thing that I know about North Korea something that I read in the newspaper, something that my friend told me, or something that I saw in The Interview? They're not really very good at keeping those things separate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking to Jeff Zaks about his book, Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Let's go to the phone now and speak with Andreas in Dallas. Hey, Andreas.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
So should I just ask my question?
Please.
Okay, cool. So I was wondering, how does your brain process, say, a screen that's pixelated rather than real life? And does that cause more of a strain on, I suppose, the visual processing centers of your brain? And how does your brain kind of consolidate all of that information?
Interesting question.
Differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first thing to say is, yes, low contrast images and low resolution images do produce, you know, eye strain. They do produce fatigue more rapidly than higher quality images under most circumstances. And the second thing to say is that, surprisingly, despite that, whether it's a low quality image or a high quality image, the ultimate effect on your memory and your emotional response is not that dramatically affected. There are effects. Some of them are pretty interesting. So, for example, if you manipulate screen size and you measure people's physiological response, so how much they sweat, what happens to their heart rate, their breathing rate, what you find is that bigger screens are juicier. So people respond more to bigger screens than small screens. And this is true even if you move the bigger screen farther away so that it's occupying the same amount of your visual field as a small screen close up. So in one of these experiments, they compared a cell phone-sized screen close to a big projection screen on a wall 20 or 30 feet away. So the size on your retina is the same. But people were more affected physiologically and in terms of their emotional self-reports by the bigger screen far away. I think that has like straightforward implications for all this watching of movies on cell phones that we're doing. Probably not getting quite as much out of it.
How do movies affect our tolerance for violence?
Yeah, so this has been a question of big societal importance for a long time. And it turns out, so there's been a lot of data. There have been systematic reviews of the data, which are called meta-analyses. And it turns out at the end of the day, there is a clear effect of exposure to violent movies on aggressive behavior in the lab and a clear association between exposure to violent movies and more aggressive outcome, behavioral outcomes out in the world. This isn't a huge effect, but it's a significant one, and it's caused me to really think carefully about what I have my kids watching.
Is that a temporary effect in the same way that your mood might be lifted or dropped by a happy or sad movie, or does it persist?
Yeah, so there are acute sensitization effects, and those are most of what we were able to study in the lab. So in the lab, you can present someone with a violent, aggressive movie or a control movie, and then measure the short-term responses. You can measure physiological responses and behavioral responses, and both of them show these acute effects. To look at long-term effects, you really can't do laboratory experiments, right? And so, and you can't manipulate the variables, so you're stuck with correlational studies. But we have pretty sophisticated methods for trying to rule out alternative causes in correlational studies. And no one study is perfect. Each one has its flaws, but there have been a lot of them. When you kind of lay them all out, it's a pretty compelling case that controlling for all the other things that you might want to control for, kids who are exposed to more violent media are more prone to negative outcomes associated with aggression.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Andrew's on the line in Irving. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent. I was wondering, you talked about how the primary emotional vehicle in films is the story that's being told. How does editing a film, you know, takes and cuts and all that sort of thing, affect the way in which a story is told?
Yeah, so when I got into this work, my first idea was that cuts acted as major psychological segment boundaries. So we know that when we experience everyday activity in real life and in unedited movies, movies that don't have any cuts, that we segment that stream of activity into meaningful events. And my first idea was that, well, in a film, the director controls that segmentation using cuts. But my colleagues who study films, my colleagues in film studies, they said, actually, most cuts in films are invisible. And in fact, one of the things I like to do in talks is show people a 20, 30 second sequence and then ask them afterwards how many cuts they think happened. And we usually radically underestimate the number of cuts. So a lot of what cuts do is allow the filmmaker to show you different parts of a scene as it unfolds, and to show you in particular the parts that you would naturally want to look at if you were there. And if the filmmaker does that, it's going to seem pretty natural. And then there are other devices that signal these major segment boundaries in the action. So changes in location, changes in characters, changes in causal sequences, all of those things are how we parse up the movie into meaningful chunks. And we do that, as far as we can tell, the same way with movies, using the same neural mechanisms as we would stories or presumably our real lives.
So imagine that there's a documentary that shows someone being mugged on a street, right? It's a real scene, but it's obviously taking place in a film. If I were to witness from the window of a skyscraper the same scene, knowing that it's real, but it's not going to affect me directly, does my brain know the difference?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think we know. I think there may be a couple studies that have shown people films, undercover stories that presented the contents as real or fiction. In fact, I'm pretty sure there's been one study asking the violence question using that manipulation, asking whether whether real violence is different than fictive violence. But the bigger answer is there's not much out there, and we don't really know that much. It's a great question, though.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Susan on the line now in Weatherford. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I had a situation, well, actually, this has happened two or three times over the last several years. I always thought there was a disconnect between your physical actions and your while you're asleep. But I watched an old Western, and there was a scene where the bad guy was slapping the horse on the rear and making it run off with the buggy. And being the hero that I am, I reached up to grab the horse's rein and tell it, whoa. And I actually did that, scared my husband to death. And it kind of scared me because, I'm thinking, you know, when you're dreaming, you just dream. You don't act out a dream. Can you tell me anything about that?
So is this situation you're describing, was this while you were dreaming or while you were watching a movie?
Yes, this was in the middle of the dream. Actually, the reaching out, you know, the jumping out of bed to reach this horse's reins was what woke me up.
Well, certainly you've seen people do this during movies, Jeff. I don't know if you know about
dreams. The first thing to say about dreams, it's a little bit outside my area of expertise, but I'd say don't worry about it too much. If it keeps happening, you know, go in and tell your doctor about it. But once or twice is probably not a big concern. With respect to movies, that story just illustrates this this point that we were talking about earlier, that you bring the same mechanisms for perception and comprehension to bear when you go into the theater that you evolved to deal with real life. And in real life, it's appropriate to respond, right? What would be weird would be to be standing in the middle of a situation where there are horses and people trying to get them to move and do nothing. What we have to do when we sit down in a theater is bring some extra control to bear to tamp down those natural responses. And the prefrontal cortex may be particularly important for doing that. And in folks who don't have mature adult development of the prefrontal cortex, you can see more of those responses leaking out. So if you watch kids at an action movie, right, they're doing a lot more of overt movement, flinching and reacting and punching and kicking than the adults are. And if you watch people with some kinds of brain lesions, you'll see that sometimes they're just full-on responding, and they know it, and they're just not able to inhibit it.
Jeffrey M. Zaks is my guest. He's professor of psychology and radiology at Washington University in St. Louis. His new book is Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or email the show think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey M. Zaks, who is professor of psychology and radiology at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the book Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeff, I want to talk about music, which we completely accept as a tool for heightening our emotions, despite the fact that it is very unrealistic to have, you know, the music swell at an important moment in any scene.
Yeah, in the lab, the two things that we do if we want a surefire way of inducing emotion in people are show them movies and play them music. Both of them work great, and obviously they're synergistic, right? So if you take the soundtrack out of a film, it's a completely different experience.
Have you seen online somebody took the final scene of the original Star Wars movie where they walk and they all get their medals and there's, you know, music swelling and you're so excited. I mean, I saw it for the first time when I was about 8, so maybe that matters. But
me too.
Somebody stripped out all the music and they just have like natural sound of feet walking and somebody coughing and it just doesn't work at all. It's worth Googling to find it, but it's ridiculous. And I don't even think I was really aware of music playing when I was watching that scene for the first time.
Oh, that's fantastic. I don't know if I have anything to add, but I got to go look at it.
So are the effects of music culturally determined? Because we associate certain kinds of melodies in this culture with happiness or anxiety or excitement, but they're not necessarily empirically that way, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great one. So this turns out, by the way, to be the story for film editing, too. But for music, it's a bit of both. So there have been some really cool cross-cultural studies done on the emotional response to different kinds of tonalities. So in Western tonal music, we perceive major keys as happy and minor keys as sad. And that turns out to be in part a cultural universal, so that keys that have the intervals that make up the minor scale are produce sadder emotions than keys that have the intervals that make up the major scale. But of course, there's a lot of learning that gets layered on top of that, because there are these feedback loops where if I as a composer associate a mood with a particular set of intervals that I'm going to use them, then my listeners get used to hearing those intervals. And then if I want to communicate something, I'm going to use that same structure. And so once you have these universals in place, they have room to feed on each other. And they feed on each other a little bit differently depending on the musical culture that you're in. And it's not just the intervals that matter. It turns out the tempo and the rhythms matter too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Kevin in Little Elm. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hi, my question is, this takes place like right after I had my first child. He was about a year old. And I was watching a movie by Angelina Jolie called Beyond Borders. And in that movie, she's driving toward a tribal encampment, and they're trying to offer aid, I guess, or whatever, and they're starving out there. And she notices as she's driving up that this little child, maybe about four, maybe five, is crawling on hands and knees, all malnourished and ribs showing and all that, barely able to even make movement. And then a vulture lands behind him and is clearly saying, hey, this is my next meal, since his vulnerability and the child is going to die soon. And so Angelina Jolie in the truck screams for the driver to stop and for her to run out and go, you know, shoo the vulture away and get this child. And I don't know if it's because I just recently had a child. I don't know. But I literally emotionally just flatlined, and I was just enraged and crying. And I just because of that scene was so powerful to me, I had to turn the movie off for like an hour before I continue watching it.
I had a similar experience. And my sister, after my nephew was born, just could not watch movies in which bad things happen to kids. And, you know, I think this speaks to the fact that you don't leave the brain that you evolved to deal with the real world behind when you go into the theater, right? So there's a bunch of modulation that happens when you have a life change, like becoming a parent. And this is at the level of the representations, the mental representations that you're forming, you know, what you're thinking about. It's at the level, you can look at it at the level of the circulating hormones. You can look at it in a bunch of different aspects. And, you know, when stuff changes in your life, you recalibrate, you reconfigure the central nervous system in order to respond appropriately to those situations in your life. Well, now you go into the theater, you've got a brain that's been configured for these situations in your life, like you've got a small child at home that you've got to protect. And the brain that's responding to that movie is a brain that's currently been tweaked to be optimized for protecting small children.
I don't remember seeing this in the book, and if I overlooked it, please correct me. But are you familiar with the uncanny valley effect?
Yes, I am. I don't think I do go into it in the book. So the uncanny valley is this place between abstraction and realism. And it first came up in talking about robotics, but it's been talked a lot about in animation. So if things don't look at all real, we're fine with it. And if you shoot footage of live action, we're fine with that too. But there's a particular kind of almost realistic enough animation that really freaks people out.
There's got to be some kind of evolutionary explanation for that, like the idea that somehow something is not right when we see something that's close but not a completely good simulation.
I think
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's a matter of inconsistent cues. So let me take an analogy. There's the phenomenon that you used to see at old movie marquees where you take one set of lights and you alternate them with another set of lights, and it looks like it's moving, but it doesn't quite look like it like it's moving. That's called apparent motion. And apparent motion is an uncanny kind of sensation. Like, you know immediately it's not moving, but at the same time it kind of looks like it is. And that's because the motion cues that are driving the system are inconsistent. There's one set of cues that respond to short, fast changes that are saying, nope, nothing's moving here. There's another set of cues that respond to these longer distance things that are being stimulated by that. And I think when you look at this uncanny valley animation, what you're seeing is maybe you might be seeing color and shape features that are hyper-realistic, but motion that's not quite right. Or you might be seeing motion that's okay, but size relationships that aren't quite right. And that disconnect between realistic cues telling you that this is a real thing and cues telling you that it's not a real person, I think that's what produces the uncanny valley.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Pam on the line in Lake Tyler. Hey, Pam.
Can you talk about what the handheld camera, how that affects the brain, particularly in shows like Blair Witch Project, which made me physically ill to watch? And I wonder if what the connection between the eye, the brain, and maybe even the inner ear is. And then the second part is watching a film like Birdman, in which there are very, very few cuts. If you know how to look for them, you can see them. But there is that conceit that it's one long shot. So I wondered if you could talk about those two kinds of shooting and how they affect the brain.
Thanks, Pam. And I'm right there with you with the shaky cam. So this is great.
Yeah, let's start with that one. Those are both great questions. So how do you know where you're pointed and how you're moving? Your brain gets information from your eyeballs. And one important information is what's called optic flow. It's how the image on your retina changes as your eyeballs move. Okay, so if you turn your head to the right, everything hitting on the retina moves systematically. Another way that you know how you're pointing and where you're moving, as the caller said, is from your inner ear, from your vestibular system. So you've got a set of little levels in your inner ear that that feed information to your brain about your current orientation and acceleration. And if you are watching a film that has a lot of visual information signaling self-motion, but you're not getting any signal from your inner ear, that's a cue conflict that is really aversive. We think that why it feels bad is because one of the situations in evolution, in our evolutionary history, that would produce that kind of cue conflict is an infection affecting the inner ear. So it turns out inner ear is one of these kind of canary in the coal mine parts of the body where if you get sick, it's one that's likely to go bad. And so if you eat something that's bad for you and you start getting a disconnect between your what your inner ear is telling you, what your eyeballs are telling you, you might want to vomit up whatever it is you just ate. And so that's why – that's thought to be why you get this nausea response from that particular cue conflict.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The other part of her question was about Birdman. I don't want to forget Pam's other question.
Yeah.
Very few cuts, notably few for a modern film.
Yeah, regrettably, I haven't seen Birdman yet. I'm itching to see it. But long takes are one of these great things in film. So on the one hand, the rate of editing has been getting faster and faster over the last 70 years. And in typical Hollywood films, we're down to an average cut rate of like one every 3 to 4 seconds. On the other hand, there are filmmakers all throughout the history who have eschewed the rapid cutting and instead preferred long takes where the camera runs for a good long time. So Jim Jarmusch is a current example of that kind of filmmaking. Orson Welles was famous for his long takes. And there are some really extreme cases. So there was a film released in the early 2000s when digital technology made it possible to shoot things longer than a can of film. The film's called Russian Ark. It's filmed all in the Hermitage Museum in Russia, and it's one continuous run of this camera. It's got a cast of about 1,000 people. It's this amazing tour de force. And definitely filming without editing changes what the filmmaker can do to the viewer's experience. One of the things that is typical if you have a relatively static camera in long takes is that the viewer can look around a lot more. So if you track people's eyes, they're less likely to be looking at exactly the same thing. They have more independence. On the other hand, if you have a long take that has a lot of tracking motion, then you can get an experience where you're controlling the viewer's eyes much more like with editing, but you don't have that jumpiness, that discontinuity.
You know what's really astonishing is that if we see a good enough film that is subtitled, acted in a foreign language and subtitled for us in English, I've had the experience of forgetting that and recommending the movie to a friend, and then they come back and say, well, it was full of subtitles.
That's great. So I think that speaks to two things that we were talking about earlier. One is where we started with the notion that at the end of the day, what you're doing is building a model of the events that are depicted by the film in your head, and that's what really determines the depths of our emotional response and our long-term memories for the movies. The other speaks to the fallibility of memory, right? So we have a hard time getting really clear on where particular perceptual details came from. You know, was that a voice that I actually, are those words that I actually heard uttered in the film, or are those the words that I heard in my head as I read the subtitles?
Can you explain why people get so excited when they finally see in person a celebrity that they've seen in the movies?
No. I do it myself.
There's not a brain thing that explains this. You know what I mean?
There's got to be a brain thing. I just don't know what it is. You know, there's a effect that in perceptual psychology and social psychology called the mirror exposure effect that's probably relevant here. And what the mirror exposure effect says is that other things being equal, things that we've seen lots of times before, we like better than things that are novel.
Hmm.
My favorite demonstration of this came from a study where they took out ads, classified ads, in the college newspaper in East Lansing, Michigan, where I grew up. And they advertised random letter strings. And so some of the letter strings were just in the paper once, some were twice, 4 times, 8 times, 16 times, 32 times. And they just put them in the paper over the course of the semester. And then they brought in their undergraduates who were taking introductory psychology at the end of the semester and just said, here's a bunch of random letter strings. How much do you like them? And sure enough, they like the ones that were in the paper more. So I think, you know, we like stuff that's familiar, but that doesn't begin to explain, you know, how crazy people get about celebrity in this culture.
Jeffrey M. Zaks is professor of psychology and radiology at Washington University in St. Louis. His new book is called Flicker, Your Brain on Movies. Jeff, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.